Sunstone presents Burden or Pleasure, a profile of polygamist husbands, recorded live at the 1986 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 20th through the 23rd. We take you to the Salt Lake Sheraton and Towers, where the program is just now beginning.
This one is Burden or Pleasure, a profile of polygamist husbands, just so that all of you know that you're in the spot you want to be. And also would like to remind you that this conference you need to be pre-registered for. So if any of you are here and haven't registered, please see somebody out at the registrar's table. Okay, our speakers today, Jesse L. Embry is the Oral History Program Director at the Charles Redd Center for Western Studies. Did you get all that? And an instructor of history at Brigham Young University. She received a master's degree in American history at BYU and has worked for the LDS Churches and California State University Fullerton Oral History Programs and the Utah State Historical Society. She is currently completing a book-length manuscript on LDS family life around the turn of the century based on oral histories conducted by the Redd Center. She has published articles and presented papers at professional conferences on LDS polygamy, Mormon women, oral history, and Western American history. The comment is going to be made by Martha S. Bradley, who has also been the chairman of this whole Sunstone Symposium. Other accomplishments are she's a PhD candidate at the University of Utah in American history. She has written and published articles on the subject of polygamy in Dialogue and the Utah Historical Quarterly. And probably her greatest accomplishment is that she has 6 children, and they're all wonderful. And no, they have a mother, even though she's so busy. Take it away.
In 1889, when Thomas Edward Taylor was 40 years old, he married 24-year-old Brigina, we'll call her Minnie, Christensen as his third wife. Thomas ran a feed and grain co-op in Salt Lake City and spent most of his time there with his first wife, Emma, and his second wife, Mary Ann. And Minnie spent most of her time at her mother's, mainly in Gunnison, but in other parts of San Pete County. Unlike most plural couples, Thomas and Minnie spent most of their married life apart, and therefore his letters provide an interesting case study of how men responded to polygamous family life. The first letter is dated July 1890 and is addressed to my dear M.W., probably referring to my dear wife Minnie some way, probably to avoid attention from the marshals and to prevent possible arrest. Although he later addressed his letters directly to Minnie by name, his first correspondence was very formal. Although they imply love, the words spoken are of business and daily life in Salt Lake City. Minnie apparently has some very severe insecurities about their relationship, and at times it seems that Thomas almost lectures her. For example, on March 28, 1991, he wrote, "I do not wish you to understand that I would not have an opportunity to pay any attention to you, nor that there would be any reason for you not coming up to General Conference in April. But with so many visitors and meetings, we will be going all the time. As for you staying at your Aunt Minnie's, I could not consent to that. I have a home, and I expect my wife to come to it when here. I appreciate your motive in relieving possible embarrassment, but do not think our conference visitors would give us any hassle. Most of them understand our relationship." On April 3rd, 1892, he again responded to Minnie's request about coming to conference. "Regarding you being in the way when here at conference time, my wife must not consider herself to be in the way in her husband's home. She must be prepared at all times to aid both him and those who may be his guests." The letters that Thomas wrote from England were much more personal, and he talked about business still, and especially about finances. Apparently, he had expected the people to pay money for debts, but they didn't always come through, and so sometimes he had absolutely no money to send to Minnie. But he also wrote about the relationships between his wife, and usually this appears to be responding to a letter that Minnie wrote. Of the collection that I read, there's only one letter of Minnie's, all the rest are Thomas's. He wrote, "You mentioned your feelings about not having to do anything to injure the feelings of others of my family on your behalf. That is the right kind of spirit to have, and lived will give you peace and happiness." A couple of months later, he wrote, "I would like Emma, the first wife, to be frank with you and you with her, and each learned the lesson of humility. I am your husband as well as hers. Apparently the wives were not communicating, and Thomas sent a letter to Minnie and asked her to either mail it or take it to Emma. Quote, I hope you can see your way to do this in the spirit of meekness and love, not only for your husband's sake, but for yours and your family. There are also some messages of love. On June 28, 1893, he wrote, I've sometimes thought lately that my letters might have given you pain, and that I've said things in there that appear differently in a letter than if I could have talked with you, having you laying in my arms. Minnie complained when Thomas referred to his children as ours, since she had no children of her own. He explained, while you've given birth to none of them, none were nurtured in your womb or were drew nourishment from your breast, yet they are ours, and I would have them love you and know you. Another time he wrote, do you remember soon after we were married, we were going to change our temple clothes, my taking you in my arms, and as I kissed you, saying, my wife. In 1896, Minnie gave birth to her only son, and later Thomas reflected on the joy of being there for that event. After the son's birth, he started giving some childbearing advice. Alfred will no doubt be a pleasure to you, but on account of him being your only child, you must not neglect that he is taught correct principles. He seems to be getting along well with his teeth, and it is hoped that if he will grow strong physically and bright mentally. Thomas' letters express some of the concerns of LDS polygamous husbands. While a number of studies have been written dealing with Mormon polygamy, they mainly dealt with wives and children, and there have been very few written about men. The exceptions are a couple of articles by James Hewlett and Kimball Young, and both of their articles contend that polygamy offered men, quote, ego security and higher status because of the possibilities of having additional sexual partners and the prestige in the Mormon society of having more than one wife. But there also were certain, quote, certain insecurities because polygamy was so contrary to their monogamous traditions. These conclusions, while true in some cases, underplay Thomas Edward Taylor's experience. Rather than a burden or pleasure, the title of my talk, or an ego security or insecurities, men practiced polygamy because of their religious beliefs. And there were similarities, although there were expected differences between their monogamous counterparts in both the LDS and the American background. And as I thought about writing this paper, I remembered Eugene Campbell, who was a professor at BYU, thinking, now they did not practice it for religious motivations, but that's what the evidence comes out as. Most LDS husbands married in polygamy because they believed in the principle. While sexual motivations cannot be completely ruled out, the 19th century view, at least according to the manuals, was that intercourse was only for procreation. It was actually dangerous to one's health. The men writing about their reasons for marrying in polygamy almost universally expressed religious motivations. William G. Ashworth wrote, for example, for some time past, I've been considering entering this order of marriage and have talked it over with my wife, Mary. I loved my wife and felt that I had in her all I desired in a companion, but with the faith I had in the authorities, I felt it my duty to obey their counsel. He added that he had heard from church leaders that if the brethren did not embrace the doctrine, they are in danger of losing their wives because they will be given to husbands who will exalt them in the higher glory. Andrew Hansen wrote in his autobiography about his marriage to his third wife, to future generations who will have been brought up under monogamous conditions, the foregoing will no doubt seem absurd. But again, I make no apologies. I owe none. Celestial and plural marriage is a law of heaven, and at that time it was enforced among God's people on earth, sanctioned and approved by him, and I knew it. The modern perception of men and women marrying for love was rarely mentioned in marriage manuals during the 19th century. Love should be a guiding star, the marriage manual said, but it should not be the final deciding point. A married couple should feel love for each other, but the love should go out of the relationship rather than be the cause of it. Instead, men and women were to consider religious character and physical characteristics rather than love when they chose to marry. Plural husbands seem to have had the same feelings about love. When Ida Stewart Pansy asked her father, Andrew J. Stewart, how he could have married two women, he said, I could love them just as you could love two children. Marital love was not seen as something exclusively for one person. learning to work together for common goals, and including the ultimate reward for the LDS of eternal life, was more important than physical attraction. After telling of his love for each of his three wives, as long as they were faithful to him, Joel Hill Johnson, who loved to write poems, but they're sort of tacky poems, wrote, "Should each prove true their work to do, like true and faithful wives, then all shall share my love and care with crowns of endless lives." With this attitude about love, 19th century courtship in monogamous and polygamous family were different than they are today. As one historian has said, "Of course there were courtships in the Midwest. After dances and church meetings, young men would ask young women, 'May I carry you home?' And when the relationship had progressed to the stage where the suitors was calling on the young woman's family, the couple would say that they were sparking." I read some of the polygamous records, and they talked about sparking, and I could never quite figure it was, but if you're actually courting, that's sparking. These courtships were very short, and by our standard, were very formal. Mormon polygamous husbands varied in the amount that they mentioned about their courtship. Some of them write hardly anything, and some of them will write very detailed accounts, particularly stories about courtships of second and third marriages were sometimes either long or very short. Some of them were so short that it really surprised me. For example, Christopher Layton wrote in his autobiography, "On April 12, 1856, Carolyn Cooper and I were married in Salt Lake City, President Brigham Young officiating." And then on August 2, 1862, he wrote, "Rosa Ann Hudson and I were married in Salt Lake City, Daniel H. Wells officiating." He hadn't even mentioned these other women earlier in his autobiography. And William Foote recorded in his autobiography that he went to Provo in February of 1856 to visit Elijah Maria. On the 2nd of March, 1856, he recorded, "Elijah Maria Ivy was sealed to me by President B. Young in his office at Salt Lake City. She was born on the 29th of March, 1842. She was 14, and that was very unusual, by the way. Marrying a plural wife has often been seen as an advantage to men, especially those who might have trouble with their other wives, and or who were looking for a fresh partner. However, courting another wife was not always enjoyable for the husband. Andrew Hansen said that he frequently heard comments such as, "He should worry, he's going with a young girl to have a good time," and other such remarks, Hansen goes on to say, as natural to be considered, for such thoughts could only exist in a corrupt mind. "But my heart was very much back with my wife and dear children, four of them, which I loved with a young father's affection, and I knew that I had left hearts behind that were heavy." The Victorian ideal of the role of husband and wife were different than current values. While who predominated in a marriage depended on the individuals, 19th century men and women had separate spheres of responsibilities, which kept them apart most of the time. According to the article, "The Cult of True Womanhood," the 19th century American man was a busy builder of bridges and railroads, at work long hours in a materialistic world. A husband was expected to provide for his family, and home was where the wife provided a refuge for the husband from the world of work. Because of this division of labor, American society was characterized in large part by rigid, gendered role differentiations with the family and within society as a whole, including which led to an emotional segregation between women and men. This pattern was true in LDS, monogamous, and polygamous families. The number of wives was not the determining factor on the relationship or on the division of labor. Agriculture was the primary source of income for Mormons throughout the West. Of my study, 185 polygamous men and 118 monogamous men, 58% of the polygamous and 62% of the monogamous were involved in farming, ranching, merchandising, or freighting. These were categories that Kimball Young used in his book. And over half of those, 57% of the plural husbands and 58% of the monogamous, were farmers or ranchers. Families raised nearly all their foods and produced nearly everything they used, and cash was sometimes scarce. Men and women had specific work assignments. The men usually worked in the fields, and the women worked in the home, sometimes took care of the garden, and took care of domestic animals. Besides working in the fields, the husbands also occasionally had to have other occupations just to be able to support the family. So quite often, in addition to being a farmer, he would be a freighter, or in the case of one plural family, Charles L. Walker was a blacksmith, a stonecutter, a farmer, and a night's watchman. And in a monogamous family, Gertrude Hudson Monson said that her father had 3.5 acres of land, and because that was such a little bit, he worked out a lot. He would go out with his team and plow. So husbands were gone. Even if they were farmers and working in their fields, quite often they had to have another job that they were gone for a while. So that Elbert Hans Anderson, for example, said of his monogamous parents, "I think there were times when mother felt that father didn't give her enough time." Of course, there's some unique problems with polygamy, since there is a plural husbands not only has to provide physical but emotional support for more than one wife. Unlike Thomas and Minnie Taylor, however, most husbands visited their wives on a regular basis. Of 156 families, which I studied, almost half the husbands, 47%, had a regular daily schedule or weekly schedule. Only 8% had no routine. 20% stayed mainly with one wife, and I'm talking about a period of later polygamy, so that might be one reason why that happened. And the remaining 24 visited either on every three days, once a month, general conference if they lived a long part away. With regular visits, the husband was aware of the wife's needs, and since 60% of the wives lived in the same community, it wasn't hard to get back for the husband to get back and forth and to find out what the problems were. The husbands were also very careful how they treated their wives. Thomas E. Taylor explained, "When a man has a number of families, he has to be very circumvent and careful in both actions and words." In a letter to Minnie, he explained that at times I may do things for you that others would feel bad about. On the other hand, sometimes something for others might give you pain, but I'm going to try to do my best in my imperfect way. Most husbands try to divide their time, resources, and affection equally between all wives. Christopher Layton said that all of his families worked together in a unity and that they always stood by each other regardless of the circumstances. And the wives and the children recognized the attempts by the husband to give equal support. Ida Walzer Skousen, the first wife of Samuel Skousen, described her husband as one of the best men in the world and one of the fairest. And Eva Cannon Webb said of her father, David Henry Cannon, "He was fair to all wives. None of us felt that he favored any of us." In order to prevent difficulties, men married in polygamy usually hoped that their wives would also love each other and get along. So just as Thomas Taylor wrote and said that he hoped that Emma and Minnie can work out their difficulties, Ida Stewart Paisley quoted her husband's father saying, "As the happiest time of his life was when his three wives could come down the stairs and say good morning to each other." And Charles E. Rich wrote to his wife while he was on a mission, "I am grateful and thankful so far as I know that there is a kind and friendly feeling among you. I hope and pray that this spirit and feeling may increase among you until you be one as the church is one." In their autobiographies and journals, men who rarely recorded anything about their families that mainly talked about business noted when their wives were not getting along. So David Candlin, who hardly ever talks about his family, explained in March of 1859 that, "My wives, Anna and Hannah, are much dissatisfied with each other, and hence jealousy, bickering, and strife is the result." And the next year he wrote, "I have removed Hannah to another house because her conduct becomes more and more unbearable and puts me in much trouble." As in monogamous marriage, though, individual personalities were most important to determine how well husbands and wives got along. Ida Walzer Jackson wrote, "Not all the polygamous families got along. It was the people, though, and not the institution. It was the way the man handled it a lot, and not the way the wives themselves accepted it. There were jealousies among some, but some of them got along just beautifully." David Candlin said, after he put Hannah in another home, said, "I absenced myself sometimes for weeks, and then she'd crave forgiveness." Charles Rich joked with his wives. He wrote to his wife, Eliza R. Rich, and said, "I've had two letters from all of you." He had four or five wives since I left home. "It's been such a long time, I've forgotten the date of receipt. I think if I had one or two more wives, I wouldn't hear from you at all." Christopher Layton recalled his love for his third wife. "Death came to the relief of my wife, Sarah M., on October 25th, 1864. This is a great blow to us. For in her we lost our best advisor and peacemaker, a true wife, a loving mother." rearing children was also viewed differently in the 19th century. Since the husband and fathers in American Mormon families were gone from their homes, wives cared for not only the home but also the children. As one scholar explained, from every available source it is clearly evident that girls and boys were raised by mothers who were faithful to the standards of motherhood. Men lived in a masculine existence out there, which from decade to decade seemed more isolated from the home life of in here. Monogamous and polygamous children felt a special closeness to their mothers in LDS homes, just as they did in American society during the 19th century. Ada D. Hartlett, a child of a monogamous family, explained, "My mother was my mainstay, I guess. Father was busy and he had a big family." Elsie Jane Hubbard spoke of her monogamous parents. "In those pioneers' days, they had to work pretty much all the time. We worked with our parents. We helped each other. But as far as spending time in my life, as such, no." Archie J. Jenkins, from his perspective as a child of a polygamous family, however, did not see this possible problem with monogamous families. He says, "My mother was the stalwart of our family and the backbone. It was through her that we learned love and affection for each other. My father never shared any sentimental feelings for our family to speak of. We respected father, but he never gave us a chance to really love him as non-polygamous families seem to enjoy with a father patriarch dedicated to a single family." As in the case of the wives, though, there were unique problems with children in polygamous families that were not found in monogamy. Because fathers in the polygamous families had to divide their time when they were not working with several families, these children did not feel as close as their monogamous children did to their fathers. I tried to take the oral histories and to figure out what they were saying about the relationship to their fathers. And of 63 families where the children talked about this relationship, 13 said that they were received no attention from their fathers. 52% said they had little interaction with their fathers, and 33% said that they were close to their fathers. In contrast, 84% of the children from 41 monogamous families felt that they were close to their fathers. Marjorie Cannon Pingren said, "I was not neglected, but it seemed to me I grew up with very little regulating because my father had another family that he lived with part of the time. He supervised us as best he could, but I can't remember that I was ever forced to study or guided my assignments." But although they were not always present, fathers expressed love for their families. Teaching religious values was considered to be one of the most important things. As Martin B. Bushman wrote, that he made it his practice to live with each family and to help them with their children and to have prayers with them. "I tried to set a good example before my children by having prayer night and morning. Of 79 polygamous families, a husband and all of his wives counting as one family, and 76 monogamous families, 90% of the polygamous and 85% of the monogamous, nearly all of them, had some type of family prayer. And these family prayers continued in both monogamous and polygamous homes when the father was not there. Just as men rarely recorded information about the relationships with their wives, they also recorded very little bit about their children except when they were born or they were sick. In some of the autobiographies and journals I've read, the man carefully recorded when each of his children was born. For example, John Brown wrote, "February 3rd, 1859, my wife Elizabeth gave birth to a son. June 11th, 1859, my wife Margaret gave birth to a daughter. July 7th, 1859, my wife Amy gave birth to a daughter." Warren Foote remembered in 1865, after returning from his mill, "I found my little son, Sidney Wallace, sick with a diarrhea. He continued to pine away, and he had no appetite until the 8th day of September, when his spirit left his little body. He was the son of my second wife and always wanted to be with his dad. Two of my little one's sons have been taken from me within 9 months. Oh, may they be restored to me in the resurrection." On the 1st of July, 1879, a plural wife, Lucy, wrote to Samuel Russell shortly after he had left, "I think the boy is getting more teeth. He's a little restless and seems very fond of green apples. The day after you left, he had a harder cry than I'd ever heard from him, and we tried every means to pacify him, and then we concluded the crying was because he missed you." Polygamy did not completely change the 19th century Victorian ideal of family relationships. Husbands and wives were gone, often in polygamous families as well as monogamous families. The unique situation came because a man had more than one wife and had to divide his time up more. But that does not mean that the family life was not important. Plural husbands and fathers tried to maintain good relationships with all their families. Charles Richard's letter to his plural wives, written on the 11th of January, 1863, while he was on his mission, summarized the hope of many plural husbands. Now, my dear wives, how be it with you? Do you enjoy yourselves? Do you enjoy the Holy Spirit? Do you pray? Do you teach our children to pray? And do you see that no unholy principle that will destroy them is suffered to grow in their minds? Do you attend meetings faithfully? Do you cultivate love for each other? Do you love and remember an absent husband? I trust that you remember all these things and many more. Thank you.
The most wonderful part about this letter that Jesse just mentioned is the beginning. He puts, Dear Mary, Elizabeth, Eliza, he lists all of their names. Very personal approach to writing to your wives. Before the 1960s, history dealt primarily with large topics, with wars and with depressions and recessions, with the movement into the frontier, with urbanization, with large themes and with movements and cycles. The 1960s, of course, were a time when the nation turned its attention to the interests of special groups or classes of citizens. And since that time, historians, in much the same way, have increasingly directed their attention to special classes or groups of citizens, minorities such as blacks and Chicanos, women, immigrants. In a sort of affirmative action history, basic American history books are being rewritten to include mention of the important things that blacks were doing throughout our nation's history, to describe the history of the women's movement, and to describe the daily life of women and men, or to better cover the broader picture rather than just portraying the power center. Women's history has become a very popular specialty. I won't say anything bad, I promise. Okay. When you go to the bookstore, there's always a special section that says women's studies, and all the books in the women's studies section deal with women's issues. Can you imagine finding a similar section in a bookstore that says men's studies or, deals with men's issues? We just don't see the same kind of attention to men's issues. This paper is a healthy and, I think, enthusiastic effort to articulate what is perhaps a forgotten genre of history, describing polygamy from a male perspective. And as far as I know, it's the first paper that's ever attempted to do so. It is really ironic that in describing a system that is so patriarchal, that for many represents the ultimate situation in terms of male dominance, in terms of ideological framework, or physical and emotional construction, that what histories we have describe polygamy from the perspective of a female. They describe the lives of women and women and their children, but for the most part don't address themselves to the concerns of men. This paper studies how men describe their relationships with their wives in letters, in discussions with their children, and in their journals. It does not, then, describe every 19th century man, but 19th century men in relationship to their family. There were many things that men did not mention or talk about in their letters. There are many things that they probably did not consider important enough to talk about or to discuss. Emotions, for the large part, were not a part of the repertoire of the man. Fear and insecurity and depression, discouragement were surely felt, but not articulated, not admitted or discussed. They did not write about how they felt about things, but just described events. To determine, then, how men felt about polygamy, how they felt about their wives, and how they felt about their children, you must go around and around the issue with the men and try and understand them and how they felt and what they were trying to say. What was the purpose of these families, and why were they formed? Jesse has shown that the primary justification for polygamy was religious, that families were the basic unit through which the values and beliefs and teachings of Mormon society were perpetuated. The reproduction of saints came through families. Men chose women capable, strong, hopefully fertile enough to assist them in this important work. And as marriage was part of religion, so was love. And love was definitely sought after in these relationships. The love that existed in these families, the typical monogamous or polygamous family at the turn of the century, was not the highly eroticized emotional bonding that exists in today's marriage relationships. It was more sentimental than those unions that existed at the first of the 19th century, but again, it was very different from the types of marriages that some of us have today. Love was spoken of and valued, and they were not loveless, practical unions only. Love was something they really considered an important virtue, and when it was not present in marriage, it was considered a great loss. It seems to me that the emphasis needs to shift in our study of polygamy from looking at this unique structure, the thing that makes them unique, of course, is that there's one husband and several wives, to those elements that makes a polygamous family much like a monogamous family, which is the main story, as far as I'm concerned, of polygamy, and that story would be how people got along with one another. This study does just that, I think. It portrays the struggle that many men had trying to keep many women happy, satisfied, and peaceful. It describes their incredible maneuverings to spend time with each of their wives and with their many children. I think that you get a sense of the frustration and the exhaustive effort that it must have demanded. It took incredible obedience to stay in a happy marriage. You often hear women say that if they bring polygamy back, that that's when they'll leave the church, or that they would rather kill their husband than share him with someone else. And perhaps some of our husbands have legitimate concerns as well. And these could be based on the historical experience of the church. A modern-day polygamous marriage would mean supporting three different women at a Nordstrom sale, for instance, or three different women's Diet Coke habit, or trying to adjust to the menstrual cycle of three different women, which I would think would be very difficult. I think even trying and really believing that you could love three different unique human beings would be a strain. If you really did prefer the company of one of them, but you knew that you needed to make every marriage work, that would always be with you, and I think it would make every relationship more stressful. I'm not sure that the promise of the title of this paper can ever be answered. If you know it in your program, it's called Burden or Pleasure. The primary reason, again, I think, is that men just didn't talk about sex in their letters or in their journals or to their children. While they did talk of affection, as did women, there were some things that were not considered proper discussion. And I wonder if in Victorian America, if men and women even talked to one another about their sexual functions or dysfunctions. The second body of data that Jessie uses for her study of polygamy is a group of oral histories that were done with the children of polygamists from the late 19th century. And again, I think that they are very little help in answering this question. I don't think children of any day and age have a realistic notion of what their parents are doing behind their closed doors. By maintaining that the primary justification for men entering polygamy was religious, a faithful adherence to a religious principle, you cannot discount the fact that one of the bonuses, and maybe many of them considered it a blessing, for their faithfulness was often a lot of fun. Again, I'm not sure that we can satisfactorily answer these questions. A psychologist, maybe Jess Grosbeck is the person for this, could look at their letters, the letters they wrote to their wives and their children, and try and find double entendre or slips that they make, trying to figure out how they felt about sex in these relationships. But I feel really uncomfortable about that type of analysis. So I just don't see how you can ever really be sure that they meant what they were saying. When I was a freshman at the University of Utah, I was studying to be an artist, and I took the foundation drawing class, and part of my final portfolio was a drawing done of two cowboy boots, and one was laying on its side and the other was upright. And my professor stood back from that drawing, and I can remember my heart was just pounding in my chest, and he stood back from it and he said, "This drawing is fraught with sexual overtones." You know, I'm this 19-year-old, naive, little Mormon girl, and I just burst out bawling because I felt that perhaps I had inadvertently revealed my darkest and deepest self, which I did not understand, and I wasn't quite sure I wanted to understand, and I quit art altogether. In hindsight, acknowledging that I overreacted dramatically, I admit that, but I have come to decide that sometimes cowboy boots are just cowboy boots. And I am willing to take these men at their word. I'm really excited about Jesse's forthcoming volume on polygamy. I think that it will more satisfactorily and completely answer some of these types of questions about the types of lives that these men and women in polygamy lived at the turn of the century. Thank you.
Jesse Embry and Martha Bradley for their thoughts today. And now there is some extra time if there are any questions that you have for either Martha or Jesse. Kimball Young's Isn't One Life Enough many, many times, and the oral histories that we've done at the Red Center are based on his book, basically, and so I came up with some interesting information. In addition, some of the people where we interviewed younger members of the family, he had interviewed the older members. I have read his research notes. And I think that the misgiving thing about Isn't One Wife Enough is that the title, Kimball Young found that most families were successful, and one of the major points that he makes throughout his book is that there wasn't that much difference between monogamous and polygamous families, and the polygamous families adopted their monogamous traditions. And that's the same conclusion that I come through using many of the same resources plus many more resources than he used.
More and more polygamous families in the past 20 years are independent, practicing polygamy independent of an organized group. And in those families, the relationships vary as much as they would from my family to your family to the next one. Polygamous families, even today, are heavily patriarchal. And I think that's probably the most distinctive characteristic. But I've interviewed several polygamists that are practicing polygamy right now that have very open relationships with their husbands and their sister wives that are more like the relationship I have in my family than it would have been with a 19th century polygamist.
There's a study of two societies in Africa practicing polygamy, and the conclusion the man comes, one is a very urban society, one's a very rural society, and he says the most important thing is not the fact they're practicing polygamy, but the general culture. And I feel that would be the same way, that the people today would just be adapting to the general cultural trends of today. I don't think it comes off.
It was a good comment.
The mic went dead in my high school graduation, and everyone could hear me in the auditorium.
Yes?
How polygamous husband related to other polygamous husbands? I don't have an answer. That's the same question that that Tom Alexander asked me after he read this book. What difference did it make for the men? And in the journals and the oral histories, they talk so little about anything but their direct business that it's hard to find the answers. Any other questions? Well, we'll adjourn this meeting, and thank you for coming.